Names like Sandy Hook, Columbine and Virginia Tech, they all evoke the horrific school shootings that have become such a regular feature of our news cycle. While it may seem like devastating school violence is something relatively new for America, history shows that's not the case. In fact, the most deadly attack in the country's history took place as far back as 1927. It happened in the small town of Bath in Michigan, which is just outside the state capital of Lansing. Lorcan Clancy has been to Bath, where the tragedy took place 92 years ago, and he sent us this report.
This is the West 20 that I grew up on. Here's the barn, hidden behind all the trees.
I'm in a car with Michelle Allen Burnett. She's taking me on a tour of her hometown of Bath.
My uncle built that home. In fact, he built a number of homes as we go down this road.
Bath, for her, is full of memories. Memories of homecoming and 4th of July parades and growing up surrounded by family in a close-knit community.
I used to walk these roads after school because the bus route was so long and all the kids, my cousins, we all walk home. We'd get home way before that bus ever got back to us.
But another memory lives on in Bath, a memory of the 1927 tragedy that would affect the lives of local people for generations.
This is Main Street. These are some of the old homes that stood at the time of the explosion.
We pull up at the Bath Memorial Park, a peaceful and quiet space where the victims of the disaster are commemorated.
We're standing in front of the memorial rock that lists in memory of those who perished in the Bath School disaster May 18th, 1927.
The memorial rock lists 43 names, each one a casualty of the 1927 explosion that shook the small town.
We're pretty small. We're very small. The downtown district itself covers maybe one block.
Michelle's own roots in the area stretch back 100 years.
We go back to when my own father was born. He was in a family of 9 children, and he was the 8th. And when he was born, they lived just at the edge of the township and then bought a farm here in Bath when he was still an infant. So he grew up here.
Michelle's father, Harold Burnett, was a student at the Bath Consolidated School in the 1920s. The new school was built to provide a single, centralised place of learning for all of the students in the area, from kindergarten right up to high school age.
The others would have gone to a one-room schoolhouse until early in the 20s when this school building opened, bringing all of those one-room schoolhouses together into this one real nice building. And all the kids were together. It seemed to be a good step forward for Bath.
Bath is the quintessential small town America. When you think of the Midwest and a small town, that's Bath. Generations of families still live there from its founding days through today. And many of the buildings that were there in 1927 are still there today.
Author Arnie Bernstein wrote the book Bath Massacre, America's First School Bombing. As well as being the story of a tragedy and how it affected the town and its people, it's also a portrait of a man whose actions caused immeasurable pain and whose motivations are impossible to comprehend. That man was 55-year-old local farmer Andrew Kehoe.
Kehoe's a really interesting character and something of an enigma. He could be the nicest person. One of the survivors of the bombing said to me, he was always nice to us kids. You know, he would tip his hat. He was friendly to the children. But he could have these odd, eccentric behaviors and certainly darker behaviors.
Andrew Kehoe was born into a large family in 1872 in Tecumseh, Michigan, the son of Irish Catholic immigrants. As a boy growing up on his father's farm, he developed an early interest in electricity, experimenting with various electrically powered gadgets and machines.
He eventually left his dad's place and went to study electricity at Michigan State College, later became Michigan State University. Then he went out to St. Louis for a while to study more there. He worked his way around the Midwest in the electrical business. He worked as a lineman in Iowa for a while and eventually came back to Michigan.
At age 40, he married Nellie Price, who he knew from his college days. The couple moved to Bath, Nellie's childhood home, in 1919, acquiring an 80-acre farm there, which was part of the estate of her late uncle. Kehoe, the new man in town, seemed at first a distinguished and polite figure, though he became known for some of his more eccentric habits.
Now, when he worked the farm, he would always work it in a jacket and crisp white shirt, which is rather odd for a farmer considering the dirty work it was. He stacked his tools very neatly. Some people in town said that his tool shed was cleaner than most houses in Bath. So eccentric, to be sure, but a good farmer. But he did have some modern farming equipment on his farm. Kehoe had one of the first steam-powered tractors in there, and he enjoyed showing it off, but he enjoyed tinkering, and he created a lot of crude machinery he used around the farm.
Then there were the darker behaviors. He once admitted to killing a neighbor's dog, labeling it a nuisance. On another occasion, he worked one of his own horses to death in the field.
And the rendering plant had to come out and pick up the horse, and he was furious at the horse. So there is this darker element about him, you know, certainly with the animals, you know, killing animals.
He was also known around town as the go-to guy for dynamite. This may sound odd, but in a farming community in those days, dynamite was often needed.
If there was a stump or a boulder in your field, the only way to get it out was to blow it up. They didn't have grinders in those days, which we use today. If you had your horse try to, you know, get it out, it could kill the horse. If you tried with your car, it could wreck the car. So you blew it up. And he, because of his electrical knowledge and explosive knowledge that he had, he became the go-to guy. He could blow up your boulder. So there was nothing odd about him having a lot of dynamite and what was known as pyrrhotol, which was a World War I surplus explosive.
When, in 1921, the community voted to close its one-room schoolhouses and merge them into the new Bath Consolidated School, the construction of the new building required an increase in local property taxes. Andrew Kehoe was particularly aggrieved at these new costs, believing the spending to be excessive.
When the school came in, he felt that the people in town should have a say in it. He and Nellie had no children, but he still ran for the school board. He felt that as a resident of the community, he should have a say. He was elected and became treasurer. And his books were balanced to the penny. He was immaculate with his record keeping, but he would often get into fights over how spending was to be done at the school. He didn't want anything that would impose highly on a taxpayer, particularly because he was one of the taxpayers as well.
At school board meetings, Kehoe would often clash with the superintendent of the new school, a man named Emery Hike. Hike and Kehoe were always at odds.
Because Hike wanted to improve the school, get new books, get new playground equipment, desks, you know, the basics that you would need in a school. Kehoe felt that a lot of this was extravagant spending, and he fought Hike tooth and nail on this.
With his background in electrical engineering and his affinity for fixing things, Kehoe also volunteered as a handyman at the school.
Now, there was no electricity in town, by the way. I like to say the Roaring Twenties roared right past Bath. They had no electricity. If you had electricity, as Kehoe did and the school did, it was because you had a generator that was operated by gasoline. But he had access to the school, complete access, because he was a trustee and he was handy at repairing things. So they gave him a key and he had complete access to the school. Nothing unusual about this. In retrospect, they realized he had probably used this access to carry out his plan. What was his plan? To blow up the entire school.
He was knowledgeable about electricity, so he was often called on to help repair problems in the school. So he knew the complete layout of the building, and he had, over a long time span, had packed dynamite underneath this whole school building itself.
On the morning of the 18th of May 1927, classes had just convened when the explosion occurred. The school year was drawing to a close.
And many of the students had stayed home to do farming. Their parents had kept them home because they needed them in the fields.
The explosion ripped through the north wing of the building. A number of Michelle Allan Burnett's family members attended school on the day of the bombing, aunts and uncles and her father, Harold.
The community members just started pouring into the school because they recognized the area of where the explosion had come from. A janitor came along to one classroom, my father's classroom, because they couldn't get out. The far end of their classroom had been blown off, and they had been at the opposite end listening to a story being read to them by their teacher, but then they couldn't get out, so the janitor came along and he wrenched at the door because it had become jammed, and that's how they were able to get out.
The initial blast killed 36 children and two teachers. Dozens more were injured, buried in rubble, or forced to jump from windows to escape the ruins, like Michelle's uncle, Royal.
And he had to jump from an upper window, and in so doing, he landed on a first floor roof portion of the school building and damaged his knees. And I just knew all my life, it never meant a thing to me as a kid. It didn't make any impression on me at all, except that I remember Uncle Royal always had bad knees. Now I can put it together, and oh my word. My Aunt Gertie was buried in the rubble with boards, nails and stuff poking, so she couldn't move. But somebody kept kicking her rather rhythmically, and they kicked and kicked, and finally, after quite a while, she said, "Will you please stop?" And they did. And the reason they stopped is they died.
They later found the school in the basement was secreted with wires and what amounted to about 600 pounds of explosives. They found a couple of timers that did not go off. They estimated only 100 pounds went off of the dynamite, which blew up the north wing of the school. Had it all gone off, it would have been devastating. A good chunk of Bath would have been missing.
Kehoe's neighbours heard the distant explosion, and at the same time, a fire broke out on his farm.
The school blew up about 8:45 Michigan time. At the same time, simultaneously, Kehoe's farm started a blaze. He'd wired his home to become a blaze, and he'd put dynamite in it, so it was exploding inside the house, so rescuers could not get in.
A few neighbours went to Kehoe's farm to see what was going on.
They saw this huge cloud of smoke coming from the barn area. And then Kehoe drove his truck out. And they said there was this strange gleam in his eyes. And he pulled up and he said, "Boys, you are my friends. You better get out of here. You better go down to the school." And then he drove off to the school.
And he ended up coming up to the school in his vehicle. Mr. Hike, the superintendent, called over to him as Mr. Kehoe pulled up and said, "We need some ladders." Mr. Kehoe called him over to the car at that point, and Mr. Hike was, I believe, puzzled and looked at him and said, "You know something about this, don't you?"
At that point, Kehoe took a gun, fired it into the cab of his truck. He had secreted a cache of dynamite within the cab of his truck, and also had filled the cab with old farm implements, nails, screws, bolts. The truck blew up, taking both Kehoe and Hike with it. They were both blown to pieces, and the shrapnel flew out. It killed two adults and one child who had escaped from the initial explosion.
At about 10 a.m., personnel at a hospital in the state capital of Lansing, about 15 miles southwest of Bath, were warned about the carnage at the school and told to stand by for an influx of injured children.
This was before mass communication, so it took a while for people to come in from Lansing, for rescue workers to come in from Lansing, and everybody in town had either had a child or some children in school or knew somebody. They rushed to the scene, and nobody knew what was going on. People thought perhaps the boiler had exploded, and they were literally pulling children out, pulling the debris and using axes and sledgehammers to break up boards and rocks to get to the kids.
As they came across the dead, they lined them up on the lawn and covered them with sheets and stuff. And then the parents would, as the day went on, the parents came and identified their children.
The shoes were sticking out, and some people actually identified the children by their shoes. They were lifting these blankets and these sheets that were covering the bodies, and in dread of what they would find, hoping it wasn't their child. And of course, when they did find their child, the screams were just unearthly.
At the Kehoe farm, the body of his wife Nellie was found, burned almost beyond all recognition.
We do not know how she died. We just know that she had been ill. Different illnesses had taken her into St. Lawrence Hospital, and she'd been in there. And he had gone to pick her up a little early before she was going to be discharged. But he brought her home, and that would have been just in the days prior to this explosion. And he brought her home, and then somewhere along the line, she died.
In the aftermath of Kehoe's horrific act of murder-suicide, there was something of a media frenzy surrounding the small town.
People came in, certainly. Local newspapers came in, but also the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune. Newsreel photographers came in, and there was a competition to get photos and to get newsreel footage, you know, as fast as possible.
As the time progressed, as the hours passed and the days passed, thousands and thousands and thousands of cars packed the roads coming out to see this horrible tragedy.
One of Andrew Kehoe's neighbors, Monty Ellsworth, wrote a book that same year. He called it The Bath School Disaster, the first published account of the tragedy.
Monty Ellsworth, he was a neighbor to Mr. Kehoe. He was tried to be a friend to him. He helped him. They neighbored back and forth. And then he took it upon himself to write this book afterwards.
Ellsworth recruited neighborhood boys like Michelle's father Harold to sell the books. They sold copies to the curious people who flocked to Bath to see the site of the explosions and explore the charred remains of Kehoe's farm.
And they'd pedal up to the school because there were still lots of people coming, and they would sell the book for Mr. Ellsworth. And then they'd pedal back to Kehoe's property and they'd sell it there to the onlookers. You might call that grisly. I don't. It was a couple kids selling this man's book, and he cared enough to put it together. It tells the facts. It tells what happened. It's very straightforward.
It was a national story. It became an international story. Now, it quickly was gone from the press. Why? 3 days after the bombing, Charles Lindbergh took off from his flight from New York to Paris, and suddenly everybody was crazy about Lucky Lindbergh. And in a way, I think that was really the best thing for the town, because people left them alone. They wanted to mourn their children. They wanted to try to rebuild. They just needed to do the time and the space to begin the long, long process of mourning and trying to heal such that you can from something like this.
All told, 5 adults and 38 children were killed, plus Nellie at the farm. One of the questions Arnie Bernstein is asked the most is why? Why did Kehoe do it? What motivated him to carry out this appalling act, an act which would have taken months of cold-blooded planning?
That's the enigma, the why. And as rational human beings, we want to understand why someone does something. There is no why in this case.
Kehoe left a sign on the edge of his farm, which was found the next day. It simply read, "Criminals are made, not born."
You know, a nice way of saying, "You made me do this." But he left no suicide note other than that. He left no manifesto. Now, certainly he was upset about the taxes for the school, but people get upset about their taxes and they don't plot out how to blow up schools. It's an irrational mind that does something like this. I don't believe for a moment that he blew up the school because he was upset about his taxes. He blew up the school because he was a psychopath, and that's the way his mind operated.
There are so many individual stories of young lives cut tragically short. It's hard to grasp the enormity of such loss for the families in this small community. For Michelle's family, that loss is represented by her uncle, her father's brother, Floyd, who died aged just 13.
And he was a chunky guy, and he protected my dad, who was not a chunky guy. He was small enough to get picked on, and he knew Floyd would always protect him. And Floyd also was a great ball player, and my dad always believed he'd have gone on to play great baseball in the leagues. But Uncle Floyd was killed in the explosion. And no one ever marked his grave. I never knew why, but as a child growing up and as a young adult, I never even knew because we had not talked about it. But when Daddy got older, it was his desire and mission to get Floyd's grave marked. And he is planted a space away from his parents. So we were able to get Floyd a headstone that matched his parents' headstone.
Now, over the years, it's something they had to live with. It was, you know, a scar on the land. They lost a generation of their children. I mean, this isn't something you just don't get over. Kids grew up with their parents having lived through it. This was just part of what the town was, and it still is there. It still is something to the people of Bath, and in a way, it unites them in, I think, the best possible ways.
Did many people leave the town after the bombing?
I know there were some families that left because of the children being gone. They couldn't stay any longer. Many families stayed. They had more children. They kept them in the school. Our own family stayed. They didn't leave. They used the block from the school to build a chicken coop. They made good out of it. They continued to attend the school. And many of the old Bath names are still here today.
Lorcan Clancy was reporting there from Bath in Michigan. That 1927 tragedy we've been hearing about is the subject of a book by author Arnie Bernstein. It's called Bath Massacre, America's First School Bombing, and that's published by University of Michigan Press.